Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
All right. Hello, and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're finally going to be talking about J.J. Abrams' original masterpiece for the small screen,
yes.
Alias.
Yes.
In particular, the two-parter from season one, The Box.
The Box. The Box. Every time I hear The Box, I'm sorry, I got to think of that Simpsons episode. Can't help it. Sorry.
See, I always think of Seven. What's in the box?
Well, it's a somewhat similar moment because Mr. Burns is trying to bribe some people. And he says, you can either have this large cash bribe or what's in the box? And one of the guys goes, the box, the box. So sorry for that little non sequitur there.
There you go. There you go. So, yeah. Okay. This episode in particular, these episodes in particular are maybe noteworthy because they were written by Jesse Alexander and John Eisendrath. And Jesse Alexander, at least at some point, it was working on Discovery. I don't know if he still is or not. I mean, I guess we'll just assume that he
is. If he is no longer with them, he has done work that will be used by them regardless.
Absolutely, right?
Yes.
I mean, he's got to be, right? He was a co-executive producer and a writer. And yeah, and maybe still is. So yeah, but even if Jesse Alexander is not working on Discovery anymore, there's a lot of Star Trek people who did work on this show and on these episodes. You know, J.J. Abrams created it, obviously. Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman were heavily involved throughout the run. And if you look at the people behind the scenes, it pretty much is the crew of all of J.J. Abrams' movies, including Star Trek 09 and everything. Giacchino is the composer, you know, and then the editor.
Isn't Sidney's dad, didn't he play the Klingon in the cut scene from 09?
Yeah, Victor Garber. Yep.
Yeah.
For sure. The editor, I don't know about the editor on these particular episodes, but in general, I think both Mary Jo Markey and Marianne Brandon, you know, worked on the show. Which is cool. Marianne Brandon edited part two of this two-parter. And yeah, you know, some other people scattered throughout. Greg Grunberg is in there and everything.
Oh, that's right. He is, yeah.
So yeah, you know, lots of Star Trek people, you know, because J.J. Abrams has his team and he likes working with them. And that's one of the reasons why I think his stuff is so cool and so distinct. In a lot of ways.
Consistent in its quality.
Yeah,
you know,
for
when,
sure.
When you get a team that you know and you can trust, you know, there's that shorthand that develops where you can just, oh, we're going to set it up like this. Okay. And you know what you're going to get at the end of that process.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you see this throughout, like, you know, even in his other television stuff. Like, I was just watching the first few episodes of Lost. And it's all the same people, even, you know, the main director, I think, on both Alias and Lost was Jack Bender, who was kind of, you know, Abrams' go-to guy. And Bender directed both episodes that we're talking about today, The Box, Parts 1 and 2.
Yeah.
For the longest time, I thought for sure that Jack Bender was going to be directing Beyond when J.J. left to do Force Awakens. I really, really did.
Oh, that's a good one to ponder, I guess. Why wouldn't he? Or did he, was it offered to him? I doubt he would have turned it down.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think when it starts, it's like Orci, you know, okay, you know, he, you know, paid his dues or whatever, having written the last two. And then when Orci left, I think they were like, we need to get a name, you know?
That's true. And, you know, but the thing is, I'm glad they went with Justin Lin.
We're
very much on record as having enjoyed Star Trek Beyond.
Absolutely, absolutely. But Bender is certainly a good director as well, as is evidenced here in these two episodes, in my opinion. So
Yeah.
So, okay. Now, I know that you have not watched much Alias at all.
Had never watched an episode before this.
So these are the only two episodes you've seen?
Yes. I was familiar with Alias. Alias was a thing. I knew it was a hit show. It was one of those shows, no lie, where it was just like, oh, yeah, maybe I should try that out. And I just never did. And so this is my first exposure to Alias. I've never even watched the pilot. I mean... It's from the era of television where they still did recaps at the beginning telling mm-hmm. you, like, when I went into the first part, I was like, oh, well, you know, I'm probably going to be able to catch up, and like gives the whole backstory before yeah. the credits. And I'm like, okay, yeah, all right, I'm caught up.
The saga cell, as it is known in the industry.
Yeah. So it was, it's interesting. It's definitely a time capsule of that era of TV making.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think that's it's like right when TV was starting to turn that corner, you know, the yeah. Sopranos had just premiered. And like, I remember like seeing the ads for this, you know, show and everything and thinking like, that seems like it would be right up my alley, you know. And then there was a part of me, you know, maybe kind of a snobby part of me, which was like, how are they going to pull off an action show with the level of action which I demand as an action connoisseur on a weekly basis with a weekly television budget, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I it's not that I resisted seeing it at all. It was just like that was not my priority by any stretch of the imagination.
And, sure, sure.
And people kept on talking about it. And it was like one of those things that I always wanted to see. And I remember going to Circuit City the day that the DVD box set came out. And
Circuit City call out. Can we just have a moment of silence for Circuit City?
Circuit City, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that place. That place was, well, the one that was by my place anyway was not good.
One by everybody's place, Mike. Trust me.
Okay. That makes yeah. me feel better. Yeah. But, you know, I went there and I got the box set for season one, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to watch this. And I just put it off to the side, and I didn't watch it for a long time. And then one day, like 3 years later, I was like, I'm going to give this a shot. Now is the time to watch Alias. And I started it up, and I was instantly hooked. And The Box is an episode that really stands out. I mean, I guess we should talk about Alias in general first. You know,
yes.
This is a show which, in a lot of ways, is kind of, and one of the reasons why I sort of love it, is it's sort of a modern-day Mission Impossible, in a sense, you know? It's got a lot more twists and turns, but the idea of, you know, like a spy who's going undercover, needs to dress up in crazy costumes every week,
yeah.
and, you know, take down, you know, bad guys. It really is sort of, and you know, Abrams has said that. It's like an update on Mission Impossible. And it has a lot of crazy twists and turns in season one, so much so that they drastically altered the format of the show in season two in an effort to just streamline it, you know, so that it wasn't a person who's working for the CIA, but pretending to work for a secret agency, which is made yes. up of bad guys, which is pretending to be good guys. And everyone yes. thinks that they're working for good guys. So it's a good guy pretending to be a good guy, pretending to not know that she
good
works for the bad guys.
Good guys work for the bad guy organization, but they don't know that the bad guy organization is bad. So they're good, but they're bad.
They think they're
and
working
she's
for
good,
the CIA.
And she's working. Yeah. But she's good working for the CIA, and she goes to work knowing that they're bad. So she's with the good guys who are with the bad guy, and they're trying. And her dad's there. Yes.
It's extremely complex, yeah. And then there is like the other component to this is, yes, it is like basically a relationship drama as well. With
yes, it is.
Bradley
yes,
Cooper once again, you know, as the...
You know, that was, I will say that was a pleasant surprise. I didn't know he was in the show. And then Bradley Cooper showed up and I was like, hey, making your bones, good for you.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he's really good in it, you know, even though he plays the, you know, the best friend who is in love with the main character, but she doesn't know that he, you know, thinks about her that way, you know.
He's also a super reporter.
Yes, he is a super reporter, yeah. And then there's the other there's the roommate. And
I mean,
then,
in a sense, Bradley Cooper's almost like a Lois Lane type character. He doesn't know that, you know, she's a superpowered character, you know. I mean, she doesn't have superpowers or anything, but, you know, like, he doesn't know everything that she's up to.
Yeah, that's
right?
True.
I mean, I've only watched these two episodes. He doesn't, though, right?
He doesn't know what she's up to.
Okay.
It's a secret. Yeah. Nobody knows. Right. So she's like
Supergirl.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
In a sense. Yeah. It's a good show. And when they straighten it out in season two, one of the absolute most brilliant pieces of misdirection in the marketing, really, more than anything that I've ever seen on television. I mean, it's just mind blowing. It's one of the best episodes of the show, but it was this was like in the middle of season two, they were getting the post Super Bowl spot, right? So
yes.
They were, you know, going through, and this is a show which, like, with a very, you know, tight-knit continuity where basically it's kind of like a comic book where each episode ends with, like, oh my God, how are they going to get out of this one? Tune in next week. You know, I mean, that's like how the show is basically structured. So, you know, they came out and they said, like, okay, the continuity for this show is extremely complex. We had an episode which, you know, we were planning on airing after the Super Bowl, which had Ethan Hawke in it, you know, which is kind of cool. They get a lot of crazy people on this show, you know?
That's kind of, wow.
Yeah, it's okay. Big. Yeah, so Ethan Hawke was guest starring, and they're like, we're going to have him on this show. You know, we were going to have him on the Super Bowl show, but the continuity is so complex that we feel that we should make a standalone episode so that people watching who've never seen the show can be like, oh, I get it. And then, you know, come back and not be scared away by the dense mythology, right?
Yeah.
So everyone's like, come on, seriously, you're just like pandering to the masses. You're going to just, this is like filler. Like, can I just skip this episode? You know, I mean, whatever. And they're like, yeah, you know, I mean, that's just, it's the thing to do. We want to get more. And the episode starts, and you can tell that they definitely were doing that. Like, there's like chroma keys on the bottom of the screen saying, like, you know, headquarters. And there's a lot of exposition at the beginning where you're like, okay, they're definitely trying to, you know, cater to this audience that's never seen this show before. But then as the episode progresses, like, everything hits the fan, right? And basically they blow up the format. And when they put it back together, it's a completely different show in a sense, right?
Neat.
And it's like, whoa, no, that what you're trying to, you know, say that this was just a filler episode? No, that's definitely not the case. Because this is an episode where, like, it's like a demarcation point in the series, and it's like you can instantly tell which episodes take place before this one and after this one, because after this one everything changes, right? And no one saw it coming. Everyone thought it was just going to be a standalone nothing episode. And then they just dropped this bomb right after the Super Bowl, and it blew everyone's minds. And I'm like, wow, that's some next level stuff right there, you know?
See, the thing is, I remember there was a Monday night football game where my home team was playing the Eagles. And it was when old ball coach was the coach, before everybody figured out that he was awful as a pro coach. And the main bad guy is talking to her, and he reveals himself to be a Skins fan by putting on the hog nose, and it horrifies her and everything, because that's a thing, that's a throwback to the Joe Gibbs era and everything like that. And I remember watching it, and it probably worked against them in my case, because they had this throwback to the, I was like, no, that's not the team anymore, guys. Don't do that.
Anyway, you know, this show's crazy, but it's awesome. And you know, just as like an extension of that, I mean, we've talked about Mission Impossible 3 in the past on, you know, commentary Trek Stars. And one of the reasons why I love that movie so much is because of Alias. And because if you look at Mission Impossible 3, it is definitely like a big screen version of Alias. And yeah. I see this sort of like meta thing going on in terms of, you know, this show and that movie and J.J. Abrams and the idea that like Alias is an update of Mission Impossible and Mission Impossible now is on the big screen and it's taking what we've seen in Alias and applying that to like a feature film. And like it really shows like what one medium does better than the other and how you can have like spectacle on the big screen with a huge budget and Tom Cruise, and then you can do like more character-based stories. And it's really fascinating to me. I don't know. It just like, cause there's like specific shots, you know, the fact that the crew is all the same, everything like that. It's like a, like two pieces of a whole, you know what I mean?
Right. Right. Yeah, no, I could see that. There's definitely a sensibility about these two episodes that are very, very much informed by the big screen. And
what do you mean by that, John? I don't understand.
There was something familiar about the plot of this. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but group of terrorists taking over building, trying to get into a vault. It was very, very. I was just on the, and they pulled up in the van that was said McTiernan on it.
Yeah,
I was like, that is just so familiar to me. It was something. It was from the 80s, I think. I don't know.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean this episode. I mean, you want to give a synopsis of this episode?
Yes. They decided to do Die Hard with Quentin Tarantino
as Hans Gruber.
As Hans Gruber. And Sydney is the John McClane character, but she has even more help. Because she has people outside the building and she has people inside the building trying to help her. And there you go. I mean, that's it. You know, and they're trying to beat Tarantino from getting to the big surprise that's in the vault, which is like the worst thing that could ever get out. You know, it's a MacGuffin.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is the worst thing that could ever be. And, you know, as a twist, of course, Tarantino is an agent who was left out in the field, and this is his revenge against the boss of the bad guy organization, who has friendly feeling, not, you know, not romantic, but like he has paternal sort of feelings toward Sydney, even though he's a bad guy. And she has conflict because she's moving to help him, but she knows he's a terrible person, sort of thing. And also she finds out that her mom was a double agent. Yeah.
Did that happen in this episode? Okay.
Yeah. That was in this one. That was sort of the emotional thing that drove forward. And that was the tie for Bradley Cooper to be doing things in the B plot.
Yeah. Her mom becomes like a regular character on the show in like season two. She spends like half a season just like sitting in a prison cell. But, you know, it's Lena Olin, I believe, plays her mom.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. Okay. All right.
So what did you think about your first Alias experience?
It was fun. It's, you know, like I said, it's very much a time capsule sort of thing. I can look back. I can say, aha, yeah, okay. You know, like I know the time period it's from. It's definitely fun to watch. But, you know, I almost feel a need to see another episode because I know that at least part of my enjoyment was Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Tarantino gets the opportunity to act, he really Tarantino's things.
Yes, he does.
It is so much fun to watch him be him. And because, you know, like for anybody that doesn't know, Tarantino originally wanted to be an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And so he relishes his opportunities to get it. And he has a very, very Quentin Tarantino film style scene when he's describing the needles that he's going to insert into the bad guy. And he's going through describing how the pain is going to be. And I mean, it was shades of, you know, Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper in True Romance. And it was shades of Harvey Keitel talking or even Mr. Orange, Tim Roth, you know, talking in Reservoir Dogs, you know, the story about the cops and the hand dryer. Like, I know that Tarantino does not have a writing credit on this, but there is no way he did not tinker with that scene.
Yeah.
Like, there's a 100% chance that he said, guys, I got this one. Let me do this.
Yeah, I would imagine that that's true. It's so weird because you see Tarantino in this, and just the idea that it's like Tarantino is going to be in a weekly television show.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like a bad guy. But you see this and you can totally understand why. I have a feeling, you know, given, you know, his association with other TV shows, he probably saw, you know, early episodes. I mean, this is an early episode, but he probably saw like really early episodes of Alias and was like, oh, my God, I'm totally into this. You know, yeah. I want to be on that show. And they were probably like, yeah, you know, OK, that's cool. But can you imagine being Jack Bender, who, you know, granted, is an extremely capable director himself, right? But, like, to have Tarantino on your set and to be directing him, I mean, like, do you think, I mean, I guess everyone would deal with that differently. To me, I'd be like, I hope I don't say something incredibly stupid or whatever, because I've got, like, one of the best filmmakers of our time,
yeah,
who I'm directing, for sure. You know? And I'm sure that Tarantino, you know, didn't, you know, want to step on his toes or anything like that. But at the same time, I imagine if Tarantino was like, what if we do it like this?
Tarantino, if there were a director on the set, like say I'm a director and Tarantino would be the type of director that I would want to come on for the cameo or something, because he's not going to sit there and say, he doesn't come across, I've never met Quentin Tarantino, but the way he comes across to me is he's not the type of guy that's going to say, you should try this, or I think that would light better. He's the type of guy where he's going to be him, and he's going to talk for like 10 minutes straight without taking a breath. And in there, you're going to be like, oh, that is a great idea. Yeah, let's do that. You know, and like that's, you just, I imagine you could use him as a resource, and probably him being him, he probably was very interested in, you know, what he could learn about how TV was different from film and how to, you know, work that stuff around and how do you approach the, you know, the scene and the situation and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's
true. That's true. I mean, I do remember, I forget where I saw this or whatever, but I at one point saw or heard him talk about From Dusk Till Dawn, which is a movie that he wrote and acted in, but did not direct. It was directed by Rodriguez. And he said that he found it to be fun, like seeing, you know, the director and the actors try to work things out, you know, while he was kind of on the sidelines. And he said that he would kind of like sit there and watch like Rodriguez talking to George Clooney or whatever and trying to interpret the script, you know, and coming up with stuff. And he would just kind of watch them do it and not butt in. And, you know, like sometimes he'd go over there and be like, it's cool seeing you guys figure this out, you know, but like if they were having a hard time, you know, with it or something, he'd be like, do you want me to tell you what I was thinking when I wrote it? You know?
Yeah.
But like, he wouldn't like be like, no, no, no. Which is like the thing that, I mean, moments before we recorded this, right? It was revealed that Ben Affleck is not directing the Batman, right?
That is correct.
He's still starring in it. He still wrote the script, but he's not directing it. And I've always found that to be like a really interesting dynamic, and one which I imagine could get really awkward depending on, you know, the personalities. Because, like, Affleck is here, he wrote this dialogue, now he's performing it, and then you're going to get a director coming in there and saying, like, okay, Affleck, the way that I interpret this scene is like this. I think that this is how you should play it. And I imagine Affleck would be sitting there thinking, like, that's completely not what I meant to do. You know, when I wrote this scene, I wrote it so that I would play it this way, you know, and it's just a very strange dynamic in terms of like collaboration.
But wouldn't, I mean, you know, somebody who's truly an artist would be very receptive to the idea of there's a different way to approach this, you know, but I would imagine, I mean, I would hope that somebody in that position would be also approaching it from, you know, watching the director interact with the other actors and seeing cues you could pick up for how you could improve the way you communicate.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you've written the script and you're seeing the director bring it across, it's like, okay, so he interpreted it that way and they're talking about, interesting. What can I do with my writing to make it clearer to people? And or if I were a director, how could I communicate it to them better? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So.
And I mean, and that is, you know, I mean, to Tarantino's credit, another, you know, thing that he's talked about, like he talks about True Romance, which is a movie that he wrote and Tony yeah. Scott directed. And he says that he loves that movie. And one of the things that he loves about it is that it's very much a Tony Scott movie. He's like, it's not a Tarantino movie. It's a Tony Scott movie. It's what, you know, he's like, it's what one of my scripts would look like if Tony Scott were to direct it, you know? And I think that that's really interesting. I just watched True Romance again, you know, this week. And,
I love that movie.
It's really good.
I love
good.
That movie so much.
It's a really,
really
good movie.
Do.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that movie so much. And it, obviously he had a different opinion of it than what Oliver Stone did with his script. So, you know.
Yeah, with Natural Born Killers. Yeah, yeah. Which he still insists he's never seen. I don't buy that for a second. I do not buy that Tarantino has not seen Natural Born Killers.
Yeah, I don't find that particularly believable. But here in The Box, I believe that he did watch The Box.
I believe so
when
too.
It aired.
I imagine that he was, you know, he seems like kind of a TV junkie, and I imagine that Alias was one of his favorites.
I could imagine Tarantino is like Elvis style, like 3 to 6 televisions on all at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
He can tell you in detail what's happening on each of them. But, I also probably that span of time watching all of that television probably, made him, I think, probably very, very receptive to, you know, working with Bender. I mean, Bender, like you said, is a name. People know his work. So, although I guess at this point, Bender was still relatively new?
I would imagine so, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that Alias was certainly the highest profile thing he had done up to that point. You know, I mean, I know he's done a number of things. You know, he directed Child's Play 3, you know, but primarily a TV director. And I mean, you know, high profile shows like, you know, just looking here, Falcon Crest and, you know, things like that.
Oh, man, he did Falcon Crest?
Yeah.
No lie. Wow.
Yeah, you know, but he was, you know, a TV director and, you know, Beverly Hills 90210. And, you know, I think that this was a show, unlike most TV shows, that really kind of allows a director to, you know, stretch their legs, right?
Right.
You
sure.
know? So, yeah, I mean, but yeah, he was doing like Sopranos and stuff too. So, yeah, I mean, he's big time for sure, especially now that, you know, TV is considered to be as legitimate a medium as, you know, movies are, which is something where, you know, Tarantino totally ahead of the curve on that. You know, he was singing the praises of television way before anyone else, you know, of his stature at least was, you know, I mean, obviously for the most part. So that's
but getting back to like sort of a point you made with the time that Alias was on the air. I mean, I think that this episode, these two episodes specifically, speak to that change, because this is definitely a two-part episode, which is a callback to Die Hard and has that feel to it. But it, you know, it doesn't let the format limit itself. You can tell that they're doing everything they possibly can with their budget and time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's a two-part, you know, hour-long show. It's basically a movie.
Yeah,
you know, they made a movie with a week-long intermission to it.
Yeah, I mean, fact that they had the same writers, you know, Alexander and Eisendrath wrote both parts. Bender directed both parts. I mean, I think that is really cool in terms of like establishing that continuity. You know.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
neat.
And it's you know, I really have to give it credit in the sense that I don't want to spoil, but there was something that happened in it that I didn't think they would go for. It was the way that they got the you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. And I mean, that's a bold choice. And the fact that they were willing to go to those places on this show, I think,
broadcast television, no less.
Yeah. I think that's impressive. And I mean, that's something which is like a game changer in a sense, not as big as the thing that we were talking about with the Super Bowl episode, but you know, that's going to forever alter that character literally,
right?
You know? So
yes. Although they did have a very quick moment at the end of it.
Yeah.
where they were like, it'll all be back to normal soon enough. I mean, you know, we were still in that era of television.
Yeah, but like, I mean, like, from what I mean, it's definitely something which was referenced, you know, going forward, you know, that, sure, that kind of thing. So that's really cool that they would do that. I don't know. You know, I really do love Alias, and, you know, watching these two episodes for this show really kind of like just took me right back to that era, you know, and made me want to watch the whole thing all over again, you know, in a sense.
Well, I don't know if this converted me into diehard fandom, but I definitely don't regret watching it. I had a good time, and I enjoyed what was presented, and if this is indicative of the level they brought it to, I won't lie that if this were on Netflix right now, I would probably be more likely to keep going. But as it is right now, if you don't have the discs, it's $1.99 an episode on Amazon or iTunes.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. But I think it might be on Hulu, actually.
Could be.
I think, anyway, it doesn't matter. So yeah, I mean, I agree with you. You know, I mean, like, if it were on Netflix, I'd probably be watching it again, too. I've got seasons 1 and 2 sitting on my shelf still, but, you know, it's a good show. You know, there's been talk about doing a revival, you know, sort of like a, you know, Alias the Next Generation kind of thing. You know, I'd be down with that, you know, depending on the format. But as it stands, I think that what we have works pretty well. So check it out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been fun talking about Alias today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It was kind of a creepy, scary, very intense episode. I really like this episode because it pulls you in and it seems very realistic. And
so you
I
like
love
Mary.
When it does it.
You're a
like
Mary fan.
Yeah, I like
so Mary was one of the ones I was kind of jokingly referencing where it's like, well, you know, if you leave this one out of the rotation, it's not really going to hurt anybody.
Oh, I definitely thought you meant the next one.
No. Well, maybe so.
Earl Grey.
And there's these spooky aliens, and like they look like ferrets, and they're fighting, and like Picard is like possessed by this like thunder and lightning, and the crew are like gonna have a like are gonna go up against him, but they're like, no, we gotta respect the law, man. And it's like that, you know, if you respect the law, someone will end up being a cloud, man, you know.
To the journey.
What would you have done?
Well, I'd have like programmed my tricorder, open the door, lob it in, shut the door quick. Try that first of all.
So you would lob a tricorder probe into the holodeck.
Hope it doesn't break as it lands.
Well, you could wrap it in like some gaffer tape or something.
Some bubble wrap.
The 602 Club.
That feels like a turning point in the movie where they seem to go toward this moral of the story that they even repeated at the end, which is, you know, don't be so busy trying to make a life that you forget to participate in the present of where you are.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. We would like to thank our associate producers, Norman C. Lau, Jeff Sutter, and Chris Steftenagel. Thank you very much for your support. If you want to be like Norm, Chris, and Jeff, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you, including early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. So just head on over there, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM, or you can find the network on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference, which is our listener forum. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and we'll come right up. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for me as Kessel Junkie on your social network of choice. You can also locate me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig and co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast, with Matthew Rushing. And you can find me on thenerdparty.com co-hosting a show called Great Shot Kid with Michael Schindler.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing, right? Statistically speaking, if you're listening to a Star Trek podcast, you're probably a Star Wars fan. Right?
I'd say the odds are pretty good there, Mike.
I mean, there's like more Star Wars fans than Star Trek fans. It's probably more likely this way than the other way around, okay?
I would say that's a fair comment.
So if you are a Star Wars fan, and if you happen to like this show, I imagine you would like the other show because it's literally the same exact show, just with Star Wars instead of Star Trek. So head on over to thenerdparty.com and check out Great Shot Kid, because it's the same thing, but different.
Yes.
So yeah, and this week we just released on Tuesday a special episode looking at the special edition of Star Wars in commemoration of the 20th anniversary of the special edition.
20 years.
Yep, we're old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of us are older than others, Mike.
Oh, well. So, yeah, go over there and check that out. You can also find me on commentarytrackstars.com, where I do a commentary track stars, which is a show where we talk about various things. We just did our top 10 of the year, and we've got a few things coming up, including a commentary for a certain Star Trek movie featuring a certain past host of commentary Trek Stars that people have kind of asking for. So look for that in a few weeks.
Awesome.
And yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right. Well, I guess that's pretty much it for Alias and for our show this week. But next week, we're going to be back to take a look at one of the movies which was shot by Academy Award-winning cinematographer Guillermo Navarro, who is the cinematographer on Star Trek Discovery's pilot, it would appear. And that movie is Pacific Rim.